is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my, oh, my. These cons. First, Tehran Tom Cotton takes almost $1 million in, shall we say, assistance. Before the, when he was running for election. Tehran Tom, by the way. Well, no, never mind. So anyhow, this is the Emergency Committee for Israel. Gave Tom Cotton nearly $1 million in his race for the Senate just 5 months ago, Eli Clifton reported. Cotton received $960,250 in supportive campaign advertising in the last month. Plus $165,000 from Paul Singer's hedge fund. Notice the pattern, gentle reader, writes Rigster over at Democratic Underground. Money comes in and a letter goes out. It's bribery, plain and simple. But I'd say it goes beyond that. There's a lot I want to cover today, from, you know, the why we have a president, to Iceland dropping out of the EU, to, you know, where's the economy going? Very, very interesting times with regard to our economy, and we will get to that, too. The Articles of Confederation, this is, when you look at what these Republicans keep doing ever since the so-called Reagan Revolution, we have Republicans who keep asserting that states have levels of power that they really haven't had since we were operating in the Articles of Confederation. You remember, in 1777, we essentially, if my recollection of my timeline is correct, won the Revolutionary War and started, well, actually, I think we were still fighting the Revolutionary War at that point in time, but we were operating under the Articles of Confederation. And we operated under those up until 1787, as I recall. And, no, 1789, excuse me, 1787 we wrote the Constitution, 1789 it was ratified, and Washington became president. So anyhow, during that period of time, we were operating under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation, there is no president, right? I mean, there's a parliamentarian, and there were a number of them, either three or six, depending on whose history you're looking at, during the, you know, the first decade of this nation. But we don't think of them as the presidents before George Washington, because the modern presidency is a much different, you know, it's a different creation. And it was created specifically, well, there's a number of functions, but the main function was to be able to deal with foreign powers. We had this total mess going on. Kathleen Duvall writes about this in the New York Times, an article, the op-ed titled, "We Have a President for a Reason." Now, in 1786, Congressman James White of North Carolina was trying to personally negotiate with the Spanish. Then in 1793, a fellow from France, Edmund Charles Genet, came to South Carolina and was recruiting people to fight with the French against Britain and Spain. In 1797, Senator William Blunt of Tennessee, plotted to invade Florida with the aid of the British. So all of this, you know, going on and not helping the country. And so they passed, you know, they passed the Constitution. They created this role of president as the man who interacts with the rest of the world on our behalf. Except when 47 traitors get in his way. They created this role of president, and they said, and, you know, what the president does, the Senate has to sign off on, right? Advice and consent, two-thirds of the Senate. But the interesting thing, these Republicans who want to take us back to the days of the Articles of Confederation, keep in mind, under the Articles of Confederation, slavery was legal. Not just Jim Crow, slavery. And being poor was illegal in the United States. Now, this, I think, tells us more about the agenda of these guys than anything. read the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. That between the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Bay, Rhode Island, and Providence, plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. We, the undersigned delegates of the states, attach our names to this these Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. Now, here's where it gets amazing. Article 4 of the Articles of Confederation. This was the law. This was essentially the Constitution. This was the uber law, the law, the greatest law of all, up until 1789. The better to secure and perpetuate mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states in this union, the free inhabitants, not the slaves, the free inhabitants of each of these states, comma, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, comma, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens in the several states. And the people of each state shall have free ingress and regress to and from any state, and the other state shall enjoy all the privileges of trade and commerce, provided that such restrictions shall not extend so far as to prevent the removal of property. Property is the word back in the 1780s that they used to describe, slaves. Provided that such restrictions shall not extend so far as to prevent the removal of property imported into any state to any other state of which the owner is an inhabitant. But the real kicker here is that here are the rules. That, can you imagine if the Constitution started out, and this is page one, right? If the Constitution started out saying, essentially, you know, we the people of the United States, in order to make a form more perfect union, establish justice, blah, 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 for all free inhabitants and inhabitants of the United States, with the exception of paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice, runaway slaves. Fugitives, vagabonds, and runaway slaves, not welcome. You know, when you go back to the history of this country and you look at where we came from, it starts to make perfect sense that these Republicans would say, hey, you know, let's go back before we had a president. Because really, you know, this is the kind of stuff that members of Congress used to do before we had a president, before we ratified the Constitution. And you've got a bunch of people in the Republican Party who don't like the Constitution, who, you know, I mean, Ted Cruz talking about secession by Texas. Rick Perry talking about secession. Rick Scott would probably talk about it, except he'd want to do it with his company. Rick Scott, one of the biggest Medicaid fraud guys in history. Now running the state of Florida. So, anyhow, I just want to... By the way, the number of Americans who have signed the petition on the 47 traitors is now almost 300,000. That's pretty amazing, too. The petition is at petitions.whitehouse.gov, and it is titled File Charges Against the 47 U.S. Senators in Violation of the Logan Act and Attempting to Undermine a Nuclear Agreement. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we'll get to that. Tom Cotton, what he doesn't know about Iran, apparently. And Iceland. Strange stuff going on. And welcome back. Kiss Kid in Yucca Valley, California. How you doing, kid? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. My name is Archie, and you know what my little acronym stands for, right?
Keep it simple, stupid.
You got it. You know, the Republicans, I know I'm talking to just the free speech people, and contribute, folks, it's all we have.
Yeah.
I'm retired. I tax myself. I'm given a percentage of my Social Security. I'm so tired of these investigations and obstruction. So how many Benghazi hearings? If I remember right, it was 441 days till we got a quote-unquote impartial hearing or investigation on the 9/11 attack. It took that long, and it was the survivors that demanded it. I spent the better part of last week calling everybody in Washington. Talked to a few human beings. Cotton's, his mail is full. Boehner's, I'd call Boehner, told him, hey, tell him to open up his phone lines. Mm. This is the only way we have to speak. I'm about ready to register as a Republican and go in. I live in a retirement town.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere I go, the first thing out is their underlying racism, all of us gray hairs.
Mm.
Tom, thanks so much for teaching us. And one last thing, if you would please, let's revisit. Remember, we talked about sedition and its kissing cousin treason. We have some treasonous war criminal. Now they're citizens. And I want to know if we the people, can take George and Dick and Condoleezza and Rumsfeld and the whole little bunch. That CIA director that stood behind Colin Powell.
Hmm.
I want to know if we can have a public hearing on their acts, because they committed murder, like Vincent Bugliosi brought up. Thanks for letting me vent.
Sure.
Love you, brother.
Yeah, good vent, Archie. And Danielle, we should change Kiss Kid's name in the database to Archie. So thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. John in Seattle. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on your cable system there. Got a minute. What's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Listen, to follow up on that guy's comment, how would it be if a bunch of Democrats re-registered as Republicans, and then that would give them a better choice in the fall elections?
First of all, you only have to do that in closed primary states. If you live in an open primary state, and I don't know which Washington state is, frankly, but it may be open primary. I just don't know. But in an open primary state, you don't have to re-register. You can vote in any primary. You just can only vote in one. But, this was the point that the Concord Coalition people were making back in 2009 and 2010 when they were encouraging Tea Partiers to become precinct committee people in the Republican Party. Because their point was that if you can get Tea Partiers holding the majority of the precinct committee chair seats, then you can make sure that every single Republican who's put up for a primary is a Tea Partier, so it doesn't matter which one wins. And that's why, John, I would say that the important thing to do is not to mess with the Republicans, but to get involved inside the Democratic Party and do the same thing. But I understand what you're saying. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fascinating stuff, you know, what's going on with this country, and you know, where do we stand, and to what extent are we being basically gamed by big corporations and very wealthy conservatives? It's frankly extraordinary when you consider. Here's another op-ed. This in the New York Times today. It's titled "A Christian Nation Since When?" by Kevin Cruz. And he points out that prior to the 1930s, prior to FDR, Americans pretty much, we never thought of this country as a Christian country. We didn't talk of ourselves religiously. It didn't say "In God We Trust" on our coins. It didn't say, you know, we didn't have a national, pledge of allegiance that mentioned God. None of that stuff. And then the Great Crash happened, and people started openly dissing Republicans and corporations and saying, you know, somehow Herbert Hoover and the fat cats have something to do with this. And so business, the United States Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, two of the largest contributors to presidential politics, back in the 30s and 40s, they got together with generous donations, again, writes Kevin Cruz, from Harvey Firestone, Conrad Hilton, E.F. Hutton, Fred Maytag, Henry R. Luce, the Fred Kochs of their, or the David and Charles Kochs of their time. And he writes, in a shrewd decision, these executives made clergymen their spokesmen. The most important clergyman for Christian libertarianism, though, was the Reverend Billy Graham. In the early 1950s, Mr. Graham supported corporate interests so zealously that a London paper called him the big business evangelist. The Garden of Eden, he informed revival attendees, was a paradise with, quote, this is Billy Graham, no union dues, no labor leaders, no snakes, no disease, end quote. He called any government restriction on economic behavior, any regulations, basically, socialism. In 1952, he went to Washington. He recruited members of Congress to serve as ushers for his revivals. He dragged Eisenhower into this thing. He got so involved in Washington in 1953, the first week of February in 53. On Sunday morning, Dwight Eisenhower was baptized. That night, he broadcast an Oval Office address for the American Legion's Back to God campaign. On Thursday, Ike appeared with Mr. Verride at the inaugural National Prayer Breakfast, the very first one. On Friday, he instituted the first opening prayers at a cabinet meeting, first time they'd ever prayed in a cabinet meeting. The Pentagon, State Department, and other executive agencies quickly instituted prayer services of their own. In 1954, Congress added "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. They put "In God We Trust" on their postage and put it on our paper money. In 1956, it became our official motto. All this happened over about a 20-year period from the mid-30s until the mid-50s. And now here we are, still stuck with it. So what do we do with this? Where do we go with this? You know, at a certain level, the second most popular TED Talk out there, the second most popular TED Talk, is basically about body language. It's about how your posture not only reflects your internal world, but directs it. I remember back in the early 70s coming across a book, Kurt Stanley, Master Stanley, was the guy who was the preacher at the Coptic church that I used to go to. And when he passed on, there was a book in his library, which I ended up with. And I ended up taking over for him, and I was the pastor there for on and off, me and John Davis, for a couple of years. And this book was called The Magic of Believing by Claude Bristol. And in the book, it kind of opens up with his telling the story of a friend of his who was very, very drunk, and they were at a party, and he sees his friend walk up to a mirror in a bedroom and saying into the mirror, "You are sober. You are so," and basically talked himself into, you know, being sober, I guess. But his point is that we can influence how we experience the world and how we feel by literally how we stand and how we speak. And I think it's really important that, apropos of that, the way we stand and the way we speak, the issues that we choose, the place that we stand in this political dialogue right now, be one, it's particularly important at this particular point moment in history, that it be one of great integrity. There is no integrity. Louise and I saw this movie, Merchants of Doubt, over the weekend. And it's an astonishing movie. My voice is in it, by the way, although I didn't see my name in the credits at the end. But it's still, it was an amazing movie. And they've got a clip in there of me introducing Mark Morano, I believe. And it's basically about how these guys, how these oil billionaires, in large part, among others, have seized control of our political narrative in the United States. And how the most important product that they're selling, the fossil fuel guys now, is doubt. And this was a practice that was pioneered by the tobacco industry. And the tobacco industry used it in a big way with flame retardants to get us to talk about our furniture rather than our cigarettes. So what are the points, the pressure points that we should be discussing?
Unequal protection. How corporations hijacked our nation. Somebody today will get a free copy when they call into the show.
We'll be back with more of my rant and your thoughts on this, your calls right after this. With you, welcome back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Amazing stuff going on here. Four numbers that prove America is a deeply messed up place. This over at Alternet. X-Chrome reposting at DU. 138,000 kids. Okay, we have 115,000 households in America who make over $10 million a year. 115,000 households. And last year, 138,000 children on any given evening or on a frigid night in January, 138,000 children had no place to call home, homeless. The average U.S. household pays $400 to feed and clothe Walmart, McDonald's, and other low-wage workers. That's a $45 billion a year subsidy that you and I are providing to big business in America. $45 billion a year that we are subsidizing big business in this country to the tune of. As $30 trillion in new wealth was created over the last decade, before the recession, 12 out of every 100 American children got food stamps. After the recession, 20 out of every 100 American children got food stamps. Why? Well, pretty straightforward. They robbed us. The banksters made off with the money, literally trillions of dollars, and the wealth of middle-class, working-class Americans has declined by trillions of dollars. This is not an accident or a mistake. This is very, very, very strategic. Tim in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about a pattern that I see. You know, we had the Israeli prime minister come talk to the Senate, and we had, you know, Tom Cotton write a letter, you know, after he got $1 million from this emergency Israeli fund. And so I just wanted to talk about this relationship between Israel, corporate media, and the military-industrial complex.
Did you read Paul Krugman's op-ed today in the New York Times?
No.
It's really fascinating. He points out that what Bibi Netanyahu came over here to do was basically to mess with the politics of Israel. He didn't, you know, that was his goal, and to get himself reelected. And the election, of course, is tomorrow. And it looks like he might have blown it. But that, you know, that the just actually it's a fascinating piece. Let me find it. You can continue your thought here. And
okay. Yeah. So I think there's a connection. I think it's very well hidden and not talked about by the media. I just wanted to mention a few pieces of evidence. You know, and I'm no expert. I don't know nearly as much as you, but I think these are really interesting things that people should look at. there's a book called They Dare to Speak Out, published in 1989 by Representative Congressman Paul Findley.
Mm-hmm.
Another book called The Passionate Attachment, which is about America's relationship with Israel, written by George Ball. On RTTV, there was an interesting video, August 19, 2010, about how Israel's basically funding the media to basically get the media to lie about certain things. And it's called Declassified.
Yeah.
Massive Israeli manipulation of U.S. media.
Tim, you know, clearly you have a you have quite a list here, and you've gone to a lot of thought and effort to figure out, or to lay out your argument about why Israel's evil or whatever. I'm not going to go there. Israel is one of our allies, and I think that's not a particularly productive conversation. What I do think is an important conversation is how Israel is going through the same Reaganomics change that we went through. It's just that the impetus for their shift, for our shift, happened in the 1980s with the Reagan presidency. The impetus for their shift happened in the 1990s. And this is what Paul Krugman is writing about in his column today, Israel's Gilded Age, is that the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel are the countries that have most held to the values. Now, I'm saying this. Paul Krugman isn't saying this in the New York Times, but I think that if you read the piece, you'll get it. That Israel, the United States, and the United Kingdom are the countries that are most closely holding to the values of Thatcherism and Reaganism, Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics. And what this kind of supply side economics does is it creates a massive wealth gap. And this is what's happening in Israel right now. There's this massive wealth gap. And in fact, the numbers, this is from Paul Krugman's piece. According to the Bank of Israel, roughly 20 families control companies that account for half the total value of Israel's stock market. And then he points out the share of children in poverty has almost quadrupled between 1990 and 2010. And then he adds, Israel's oligarchs owe their position not to innovation and entrepreneurship, but to their family success in gaining control of businesses the government privatized in the 1980s. See, everybody all over the world got affected by, you know, Reagan's worldview. It's not a good thing. Anyhow, Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yes, hello.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm sure you're well aware that the Senate is holding the selection for the new attorney general hostage in return for the Democrats signing off on the human trafficking bill as is.
Well, they haven't made an explicit, you know, you do this, we'll do that. They're holding everything hostage all the time.
True. But I think they can, the Democrats can easily change that if Eric Holder would simply start maybe doing an investigation into the 47.
Yeah, I think that would blow up in his face. I really do, Mike.
Think so?
Yeah, I do. I think that
if it's just a slight investigation to see if there's anything to do with laws, even though it may not be treasonous, but something else.
Yeah. Congress does not respond well to being investigated, and the place to hold Congress responsible is the court of public opinion, frankly, and that's what we need to be doing, Mike, is hashtag 47 traitors. That's where we need to focus our energy. Mike, thanks for the call. Jim in Lompoc, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
A couple of things, Tom. Real quick, maybe tongue-in-cheek, but the 47 senators, you know, the standard for arrest is far, far lower than the standard for guilt. And maybe a touch for the outgoing attorney general to just go ahead and arrest them. that follows millions and millions of Americans are followed by arrest reports.
Yeah, it would turn them into
credit, ability to get a job. You don't have to be found guilty, just arrested.
Right.
On your report for life. That, anyway, tongue in cheek. The second thing, you were talking about Articles of Confederation. And I wanted to mention that the same disenfranchisements there, this is my rant, hopefully it won't get censored, the same disenfranchisements that were in the Articles were transferred to the Constitution, Constitution. An example, the vagabonds, the amount of homeless we have, the felony system that are all these people are disenfranchised in the same way. And the Constitution, in turn, has given us big government. It's given us all the things we complain about, the concentration of wealth and power in D.C., the corporatocracy. It gives us people like Ronnie Reagan. And yet,
Jim, that's a hyper-simplistic worldview to say, you know, government is responsible for all things bad, and who's responsible for anything good?
Of Citizens United on the floor of the Senate.
Jim is still talking. He's not listening to me. Okay. He's going to try and filibuster me. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. It seems like I'm on here every week. I just got off of the line from Bernie Sanders' office, and I just wanted to put in a plug. If you, as a citizen, want to sign on to his Social Security legislation to support it, it's strengthensocialsecurity.org. And
got
people
it.
Can go and sign that. And I hadn't heard it on your show, so I just wanted to put that plug in there.
Okay.
And thank you for what you do.
Sure. StrengthenSocialSecurity.org. That's it.
Great. That's where people can go and sign and support that legislation, aside from all the calls I've made to my senators, et cetera. But you know what I mean.
Right. Fascinating. Okay, Denise, thank you very much. That's good stuff. And this, by the way, the whole StrengthenSocialSecurity.org thing, I mean, the whole Strength in Social Security, this is what I was talking about in the first half hour. We need to be defining the messages. The Republicans are going to be putting together a budget, right? Paul Ryan's going to work up another budget. That budget, I guarantee you, is going to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other social safety net programs. And they're going to cut those programs because they're going to say, we can't afford it. Because they're not willing to raise taxes on rich people or on corporations. They like the fact that in 1950, for every 33 cents in tax dollars that you and I paid, corporations in America paid a dollar. Now, for every 33 cents in tax dollars that you and I pay, corporations pay 7 cents. Conservatives love this. Corporatists, anyway, love this. And it's just fundamentally not right. We'll be back 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. Stick around. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob. What's up?
Hello?
Hey.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Bob.
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Okay, good. Something I tried to start a while back, which gets ridiculed quite a bit, is the small possibility when we are up against it, or should we get a Republican president in the next election. I live in California. It's a state of 36, maybe 40 million now, bigger than Canada. And all you have to do in California is be a resident for 2 weeks, have a home address, and you can register to vote. You only have to have the intention of moving to California for life. This is a thing some of our richest people do, Cheney in Wisconsin, wherever they choose to live. They may have a resident wherever they choose to. And then for the rest of your voting life, you can vote by mail and change California into a truly, shall I use the word, socialist or socially caring, kind, and conscious state. We could make this state completely.
So you're trying to get progressives all over the country to reestablish their residency in California?
Yes. Now, that is a desperate thing to do.
Yeah.
Because
especially if I have to buy land or property there before I can establish residency.
No, all you have to do is meet a nice person like me and I put you up for a couple of weeks. There's plenty of progressives. If you take California and the North Bay, that we, I'm just mentioning this as an alternative. I haven't got all the details worked out of how we need to maybe take over the cities and states. In that direction, I'd like to talk about one person that everybody listening to you needs to fight for, and maybe you can have him on the air. And that's the man running for... his nickname is Chewy, Jesus Chewy Garcia in Chicago.
Right.
He,
Jesus,
he, yeah. Yeah, he with $1 million against Rahm Emanuel's $15 million, managed to get 33 or 35% of the vote, because it's a Democratic city. Mm-hmm. So the Democratic primary is all about. And Emanuel, who is pretty much hated by anybody who's sensitive to his personality and the things he's doing, only got 45%. So now there's a runoff. And again, it's going to be big money. The major issue is the one that I, as a substitute teacher, am involved in. It's the buying of the public schools and privatizing them. Mm-hmm. The Waltons, Gates, Broad, Michael Bloomberg, all these very wealthy billionaires are for some reason determined to buy up the public school system in America, and one of the major, and privatize it and profitize it. One of the reasons is that nobody realizes quite how much money is spent on public education. 55 million children are involved from pre-K through high school, and $500 billion a year is spent on that form of education between city, state, and federal.
It's remarkable. Bob, thanks for the call and thanks for the information. Good talking with you. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dick in Congress, Arizona. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Hey, you know, the 47 traders signed the letter to the mullahs, but they also signed the pledge to Grover Norquist. And they bring Netanyahu over here from Israel to talk for the Senate. And I see a conflict. It's got me up in the air. Grover Norquist is a co-founder of the Islamic Free Market Institute. And his daughter is the president of the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is an anti-Israel, anti-Palestinian authority, and a pro-Hamas group. Now, what's your opinion on this?
I just have to say, Dick, I don't know. I'm gonna punt here. I don't know about that group. I do know that, you know, pro-Palestinian groups are often labeled as anti-Israeli, and very often they're not. I mean, you know, Israel is officially in favor of a two-state solution as well. And so I don't know that organization. I don't know the details that you apparently do about Grover Norquist, so I'm not going to opine on it. Randy in Corvallis, Oregon. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's really nice talking to you. I something a little off topic. I just wanted to know if there's anything that just regular citizens can do from that aren't in the state of Iowa that can help to bring this traitor, Joni Ernst, before a court martial.
For signing the letter to the Ayatollahs when she was an active duty member of the military?
Precisely.
Yeah. And thus violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you know, she
exactly right
disrespected her commander in chief. I think that that's something that is going to have to be done by Iowa residents.
Okay, I was just wondering if there's anything any of us could do to maybe help them along in their decision making process.
Yeah. I mean, a UCMJ trial would actually have to be initiated within the Department of Defense. So it'd be up to the, you know, whichever branch of service. She's in the Iowa National Guard, isn't she?
That's correct. Yeah. I believe she's a lieutenant colonel.
Right. So that's where it gets kind of confusing. And I frankly am not all that familiar with the subtleties and nuance of Uniform Code of Military Justice law, of American military law, whether the sovereignty is the wrong word. The authority, I guess, would be the word. The authority for a prosecution under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for somebody serving in a state militia, whether that is with the governor of Iowa, who is Branstetter, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, I might be wrong, but you know, whether that's with who's a Republican, whether that's a governor with the governor of Iowa, which is not going to happen, or whether that's with the DOD, which probably isn't going to happen. So, but Randy, I'll have to look around and see if I can learn a little more about that. Thanks for the call, Louise in Denver. Hey, Louise, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, these 47 senators have come out with these ridiculous statements as to why they wrote that letter. But we cannot let up on them. Now we've got to call their offices. They owe our president a letter of apology. And we've got to pressure them into this. They have forgotten about President Obama like he doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
But we've got to pressure him. One, as a sidebar, real quick, Tom, it hit me like a light bulb the other day about Social Security. I wish Bernie would bring this up. How many seniors die every year and get off of the rolls of Social Security? And doesn't that kind of even itself out, those coming on and those going off?
The numbers going on to Social Security over the last decade and a half have been substantially higher than the number of people coming off Social Security because they're dying out. And that's just that demographic bulge of the baby boomers, Louise.
It's
going to
be material at all.
Yeah.
Yes
and no. Actually, Louise, there's a subtle and important piece to this. From now until the mid-2030s, you're going to have Social Security taking on more and more people relative to the number of people who are paying into it, which would be a demographic disaster for Social Security because, you know, we're going from 15 or 20 workers for every retired person to 3 or 4, who are theoretically subsidizing or supporting that person. But the thing that analysis misses is that back in 82, what the Greenspan-Moynihan Commission did and Reagan signed off on was doubling the Social Security tax on people making at that time less than $38,000 a year, doubling that tax to create a savings account, half of the tax paid for people who were retiring between 1982 and today. The other half of the tax paid for put money into a fund so that people who retire from today until, you know, the late 2030s will have money to pay for their retirement. So the baby boomers are the first generation since 1935, since the creation of Social Security, the first generation to actually be double taxed, to not only pay for their parents' retirement, but pay for their own retirement as well. And then presumably by 2040 or so, when all the baby boomers have died and the number of people going on to Social Security goes back down and you get more of a normal balance, then that trust fund will have gone down to zero and we'll be back where we started in 82. So that makes sense, Louise?
Yes, I understand.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you for listening to my thoughts.
Sure enough. Thank you for the call. But Louise is absolutely right. These guys do need to apologize to the president. This is sedition. You know, this is in the spirit of treason. And that's not a spirit that's a good thing. I mean, I've been talking about this now on this program for not just the 6 years that it's been going on against Obama, but, you know, for the decade or more that I've been doing this show about this Republican perfidy, basically the Republican willingness to not just break the law, but defy the law. The Republican willingness to take down this country, the Republican willingness to destroy our body politic, all for money. This is what it all comes back to, is it's all for money. This is, you know, it's the fat cats who run the show, the fat cats who run the country. We are so in need of a populist moment in this country, in the UK, Israel, frankly, the rest of Europe is starting to gather their populist moment. They're all looking to Greece to be the ones who lead the charge. Coming up in the next hour, Dan Bongino. Should the Republican Party be disbanded?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Dan Bongino, former Secret Service agent, New York Police Department officer, Republican nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives, a radio talk show host, author of Life Inside the Bubble, Dan Bongino's book, his website, Bongino, B-O-N-G-I-N-O.com. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I'm wondering out loud whether it is time to say that the Republican Party should go the way of the Whigs. That it's been, you know, really, I would say since the Eisenhower administration, that since the Republican Party has offered any positive agenda to Americans. And this six-year crusade to destroy the legacy and presidency of President Obama has reached the point with these 47 traitors writing this letter to the mullahs in Iran last week, has reached the point where Republicans are actually harming this country.
Wow. That's a lot of information.
Yeah, well, please tell me one positive. Again, I can go back to the Eisenhower administration. You read his 1956 Republican Party platform. He bragged about the fact that they had added 1 million people to Social Security. They had added 2 million people to the rolls of unions. They had expanded Social Security payments. They had increased the pay for teachers nationwide. He just goes on and on and on. It's all progressive stuff. I don't know of anything the Republican Party has done in my lifetime that would justify its continued existence. Do you?
Well, it's interesting that you put so much faith in political parties to save you. I thought we were all individuals responsible for our own success or failure.
I didn't suggest that they should save me, Dan. I'm thinking that they're not representing anybody.
The very premise of your question sets you up for failure, that what has government done for me or for us to make our lives so wonderful? What I find interesting is you so quickly forfeit away your own individual liberty. Oh, a government will fix it.
That's not the opposite, Dan. It's not. This is not a binary choice between.
In a system where Republicans or Democrats have economies of scale, and it really is a binary choice, you have two choices. You can pick the party that runs Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, Stockton, California, and basically run every major American city they're responsible for into the ground and created epic levels of poverty. I mean, those are just the facts. Or you can pick a party that defaults to individual liberty and says, you know what, you're right. One part of your premise is right, Tom. The Republican Party, good Republicans, there are a lot of bad ones, I agree, they acknowledge government doesn't have the answers, individuals do, and we're not here to solve your problems. We're here to provide.
Dan, you're ignoring the 800-pound elephant in the room. You're completely ignoring it. And then this is the thing that continually astonishes me about Republicans and libertarians. If the choice in a system where there is massive amounts of political and economic power out there, which are associated with massive amounts of wealth or massive amounts of political power, which is what we have in America right now, your choice is not between you being free as an individual or you being a subject of government. The choice is, who is going to represent you? Are you going to have a government that represents your personal interests, or are you going to have a government that represents the interests of the rich and the powerful exclusively? We know, this study came out of Princeton just 2 months ago, Dan, that over the last three decades, the probability of Congress passing legislation that that coincides with the interests of the bottom 90% of Americans is equivalent to random noise, whereas the probabilities of something being passed through Congress that is associated with the desires of the top 1% is, like, real measurable.
Tom, hold on. You got to let me answer the question, because there's two. You're going from one point to the next, and on each successive point, you're proving me right, not yourself. You're making the point that concentrated power, whether in the form of government or economic power, doesn't represent the majority of Americans' interests. What I find interesting is you gloss over the fact.
No, that's not the point that I'm making, Dave.
The point that I'm making is that you and I, as individuals,
will never have the ability to take on concentrated power, whether it's government power or whether it's corporate power.
So the question we have to ask ourselves. That's not true. Tom, that is not what you said is not true. You can't say it and then move on.
How are you going to take on Time Warner if you hate their service?
Very easy. The way the market does it all the time, you cancel their service. Now, wait.
If I cancel their service, I got nothing.
Tom, here's the trade you're willing to make, which I find odd, and every progressive is seemingly willing to make only for other people, not themselves. You know, they want to trade the concentrated power, market power of a corporation where you can individually escape from it. I didn't like my health insurance company once. I canceled it. I didn't like Citgo gasoline, so I went to BP, okay? I can escape from it. You're willing to trade that for organized government power with the illusion that they're in it for the people. They're certainly not in it for me. I hate Obamacare, that I can escape from under the force and barrel of a gun. And you're trying to tell me that that's a good trade? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. No, what I'm trying to tell you, Dan, very straightforward, is that your interests and my interests as individuals, our ability to know that our money is safe in the bank, our ability to know that the water we're drinking is safe, our ability to know that the food we're eating is safe, our ability to know that the drugs we're using are efficacious, you know, our ability to function in this world is right now there's a battle going on between the billionaire class, the Koch brothers, the big oil, you know, Koch brothers and big oil are essentially the same thing, between big oil that gets billions of dollars in subsidies every year from this government.
Right, but that's not a Republican position. Why?
It absolutely is a Republican position.
Tom, I'm a Republican.
The House of Representatives, when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, they passed a bill that would have ended those subsidies. The Republicans filibustered it in the Senate.
Tom, this is a massive mischaracterization. I'm not telling you that there are not phony, fraudulent
Republicans.
Dan, Republicans
are the party of the rich and the powerful, period.
Oh, my God. Tom, this is like a joke. You can't answer the question. Seriously, are you making the case to me?
Go back to my original question, Dan. Can you give me one legislative initiative that the Republicans have undertaken in my lifetime that is good for average working people as opposed to being good for corporations and rich people? Because I can give you a long list of things Republicans have done for corporations and rich people. What have they done for me?
But I'll put it out anyway. How about the Reagan tax cuts from 70 to 28% in the 1980s that spurred unprecedented levels of growth?
There were no average working people who were making who were paying 70% taxes at that time.
You know what? That's interesting you say that, because the 20 million jobs Reagan created as a result of those tax cuts.
I thought government didn't create jobs, Dan.
What's that?
I thought government didn't create jobs.
No, they don't create jobs. They get out of the way.
Then how can you say Reagan created jobs?
See, I'm making my point again. Now, you won't let me answer. Reagan cut taxes, which put money back in the pockets of just about every American.
Reagan cut taxes, which put money into the Swiss bank accounts all over the world of rich people.
If that happened, let me ask you this. If that happened, and you can't, this is a question that you'll never answer because no liberal I've ever asked does. If that happened, and no one benefited from those tax cuts at all other than a few wealthy rich people, how come government revenue from taxes doubled from $500 billion to $900 billion after those tax cuts? How come? How did that happen?
Because the economy grew.
Oh, the economy grew because of tax cuts, because people had more money to spend.
Well, Dan, first of all, you're using uninflated. You're not using inflation-adjusted dollar amounts, which is something Republicans always point out.
Oh, okay. So because let's adjust it for inflation. It went from 500 to say what, 800 billion, maybe. Still, how do you account for that?
Economies grow, Dan.
Oh, economies grow.
We were in the 1980s. If you know when you damage an economy, that damage doesn't show up for sometimes decades. The damage that Reagan did. No, I'm serious. What, in the 1980s, the economy was still growing as a result of decisions made by Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower.
The 1980s was not the stagflation era? It was not where the Phillips curve went out the window. The 1980s, you're making the case to me the Carter years were good years. Carter
yes.
himself called it the malaise.
Yeah.
You're arguing against the
compared president. compared with 34 years of Reaganomics, yeah, it was really good. Our economy has been growing 1.5% for the last 6 years. It grew 3% every single decade in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right, no thanks to the government. Government was exponentially smaller.
Dan, hang on, Dan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dan Bongino, Bongino.com, B-O-N-G-I-N-O.com. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, you got it.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. No, I mean, economies just grow. You know, it's just this people, it's because, you know, people are being born. But yeah, Reagan did triple the debt and double government spending, so maybe that had something to do with it. Okay, Doug in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Yes, sir.
This is hot off the AP.
Okay.
During up to and leading up to and during the Benghazi attack, Hillary Clinton secretly released 6 pigeons with messages to the White House, and they never arrived at the White House. And Kurt Gowdy and Daryl Issa and John Boehner are really looking for those pigeons. And they can't find them.
Wow.
So if you see those pigeons with those messages on their legs.
They're at the planet Xeno right now.
Somewhere around.
The mothership has taken them. Yeah. Okay, Doug, I'm going to have to look. You know, there's an actual story out apropos of that, or are you just making up the entire thing?
No, I just thought it was a good idea.
Okay. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV there. Harriet in Jacksonville, Florida, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Harriet, you wanted to talk about Rand Paul?
Yeah, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Thanks. Couple of things about Mr. Paul. He had the nerve to stand up there the other day and say that he can't trust Hillary Clinton because of some email junk. This man has committed sedition, sabotage, and arguably treason.
By doing what? By signing that letter last week?
By signing that letter.
Yeah.
And by his own words, he said he didn't intend that letter for the Iranians. He intended it for Mr. Obama.
Which is almost worse.
Yeah, that's the biggest lie that's almost the biggest lie that those Republicans have told.
Yeah.
You know? And one other quick point, Tom, if you got in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
That 47 number that keeps coming up with the Republicans. If you know anything about numerology, 47 equals 11. You add the two digits together, you get 11.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bible numbers, number 11 is chaos.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Chaos. So, I mean, that tells you something right there, because that number keeps popping up with those people.
Yeah, yeah. Mitt Romney's 47%, and now the 47 senators is like, you know, what's the deal with 47?
And he also received 47% of the popular vote in the election, the presidential election.
That's right.
There was another 47 that popped up with them.
Huh.
I forget what it is now, but I know there was at least 4 of them.
Yeah, he got 47% of the vote. I had forgotten that. You're absolutely
mm-hmm.
right.
So
yeah. Okay. So you're in Jacksonville, Florida. Your senators are...
Rubio and Bill Nelson. I called Rubio's office, and of course, you know, it was an answering machine.
Even for somebody who lives in the state?
Pardon me?
Even for somebody who's a constituent of his, somebody who lives in state.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
He's supposed to be representing me no matter what I'm registered as.
Right.
Because he's a senator. He's not a member of the House.
Right.
So I couldn't even talk to him. But I left him a very strongly worded message, and I got carried away and made it emotional instead of intelligent, and I called him every traitor in the book.
Uh-oh. Okay. Be careful with that, Harriet. But thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind?
Not much. I just wanted to say that the oligarchs you're talking about, if you look, it's like Pope in North Carolina and the guy in Nevada. They're kind of splitting up the country into individual states.
Right, and the DeVos family in Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see a whole list of them. But what they're trying to do is if they control the state legislatures, they control gerrymandering, and then we have Republicans running U.S. Congress.
Right. Yeah, you're right. This is the American oligarchy is being established and extended by virtue of the Republican Party. It has become the party of oligarchy. And, you know, I stand by my question to Dan Bongino. Give me one reason why we should be supporting the Republican Party. And I'm sorry, the fact that Ronald Reagan gave giant tax breaks to multimillionaires is not that reason. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Well, the only thing I can think of positive that any Republican has done in the last since Eisenhower is admittedly he was kicking and screaming and, you know, holding his nose while he did it, but Richard Nixon signed the EPA into existence.
Yeah, he actually vetoed that the first time, and Congress overrode his veto. So,
well, like I said, kicking and screaming.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, but see, that was not a Republican initiative. That was a Democratic initiative that a Republican went along with. I'm asking Republicans, and if there's any Republicans listening, maybe you know of something you can call and tell me. Please name something in the last 50 years that Republicans did that wasn't the Democrats' idea, that is consistent with the Republican worldview, that helps the average working person. I'm suggesting, Chris, that nobody can find such a thing because the Republicans don't give a rat's ass about the average working person. They only care about the rich donors.
A lot of working people got jobs building things for the military.
Well,
military hardware.
Yeah, but that's a lousy way to stimulate the environment or the economy. Excuse me.
What I called in to tell you was, as far as UCMJ, the president should issue an order to the Judge Advocate General to investigate and charge as appropriate.
For Joni, you're talking about Joni Ernst letter to the mullahs while she's active duty military.
Yeah, any others that are active or inactive still holding a commission.
Yeah. Okay.
Even retired, they're still subject to it.
Interesting. So how does this get initiated, Chris?
Somebody was above the attorney general, the judge advocate general of the appropriate branch of service would have to.
So it would have to be done in the DOD.
And the president is commander in chief.
Right.
And he's the top of that chain of command. He issued orders.
He could do it. Interesting.
Investigate, and I'd say if it was me issuing the order, I would say investigate and invite reporters in, have everything out in the open, do it openly, no secret star chambers or anything. Investigate and charge as appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Chris, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Steve, in Long Island, New York. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. Every time we have a right winger on your show or any other show, they go to what I call selective history. Mm-hmm. They only, it's like reading a news article. They only read the two paragraphs and then they don't know anything after that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with history. He knows that the gentleman you had on earlier knows that Reagan did tax cuts and knew that it grew, but he doesn't remember the fact that the deficit grew faster and greater than ever before any other president before Reagan.
Right.
Doesn't realize that the unemployment numbers that they like to claim were Carter's were actually Reagan's, and it didn't even get better until after George Bush Sr. had followed Reagan. It didn't get better until the second year of Clinton because of Clinton's policies.
Right.
They tend to forget that all those that 4 years that Bush was in and the two last years of Reagan, when, like the other Bush, it all hit the fan. They don't remember that, Tom.
Yeah. Well, in fact, after Reagan passes his famous tax cut, we slid into the worst recession since the Great Depression in the 1980s. Throughout most of Reagan's presidency, we had unemployment rates that were higher than they had been under pretty much any other president since the Great Depression. And, the economy grew, but, you know, federal government spending just about doubled. The federal deficit tripled. You're right.
But it didn't,
Pardon?
It didn't grow for the worker. It only
right.
grew for the upper. The
right,
upper
and it has only grown for the top 1% ever since then. I mean, there's been you know, while productivity has increased so much that the average working person in America should be working a 20-hour work week right now for a 40-hour paycheck. That productivity improvement prior to 1980 would have been translated into increased pay or fewer hours for working people. But because of Reaganomics, it wasn't. Because of Reaganomics, it translated into more money for the top 1%, period.
And Tom, I work, I'm in Southampton, okay, Long Island. And
yeah.
most of these people that I deal with could buy and sell, you and I, on a
right.
given basis. They believe the way they talk to me, the way you and I talk to each other, that
yeah.
all these things should go in place. They don't understand what the party that says that they got their best interest in mind
yeah.
is doing, because in the long run, it's too resentful.
Yeah, I'm with you. Steve, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So where are the 47 traders going to go next? What are they going to do? What are they going to say? They've tried, oh, it was just a joke, and oh, we didn't mean to address it to them. What's next? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jason Easley over at Politicus USA writing, this is pretty remarkable. Mitch McConnell offered up a lie-filled defense of the act of sabotage that he committed against President Obama, but no amount of lies can quell the growing rage of millions of Americans. Right. And this whole thing about Byrd's Moscow trip, you know, and all this stuff, you know, Mitch McConnell just kind of making stuff up. I mean, he's not so much making stuff up as he's taking things out of context. What do we do with these guys? By the way, Joni Ernst cannot be prosecuted. Just FYI. Shane tracked this down. We're all learning about the Uniform Code of Military Justice here. Article 2 of the UCMJ, members of a reserve component. Okay, the following persons are subject to this chapter. In the case of members of the Army National Guard of the United States or the Air National Guard of the United States, only when in federal service. Following persons are subject to this chapter. Okay. Only when in federal. I'm gonna have to look that up. But it looks to me like maybe Joni Ernst can't be prosecuted. Senator Sanders, by the way, really nailed it. He said the corporate media talks about Hillary's emails. Why aren't they talking about income and wealth inequality, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, high unemployment, climate change, and the Citizens United Supreme Court decision? Let's start having serious discussions about the real issues impacting the people of our country. Right. Gary in Burke Burnett, Texas. Am I saying that right, Gary?
Oh, yeah. Burke Burnett. Hey, good talking to you, Tom.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was talking about, as a taxpayer, middle-class taxpayer in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, when they redid the tax code back in the early 80s, we were able to deduct interest on our credit cards.
I remember.
Car interest.
I remember.
House interest, 400%, I think it was, and they did away with that.
Yep.
And that hurt the middle class. So I was going on vacation every year in 79, 80, and buying a new car every 3 or 4 years. It gave you an incentive to buy a car.
Mm-hmm.
That was good for the car industry, they did away with them. And I don't think there's anybody that remembers that.
Well, I remember it.
That really hurt the middle class. As a middle class taxpayer, I had a fairly good job back in the late 70s on. And that hurt me.
Yeah. Well,
I had two children at the time, you know, and that really, really hurt the middle class.
Yeah. I'm with you, Gary. And not only that, Reagan also made it so that in 83, so that your Social Security benefits were subject to taxation. They didn't used to be taxed. And so now people on Social Security are paying income taxes. I mean, it's all kinds of changes that were made in the tax code, in the rules of the game, and how the game is played in the 80s that have, I mean, really significant consequential, huge change in, for example, how CEOs are compensated. They could be compensated with stock, whereas before it was illegal to do that. And the result of that is that now you got corporate CEOs making 500 times what their workers make and paying only 15% income tax on it. Whereas it used to be they only made 30 times, which is still that's just a mind-boggling amount of money. Even two times is a mind-boggling amount of money. Gary, thank you for the call. Robert in Mission Viejo, California. Hey, Robert, you wanted to respond to Dan?
Yeah, okay. I'll be quick about this. Look, when they say the Reagan tax cut freed up investment capital,
right. That's
right. It freed it up. It didn't create any more. There was no more profits being made because of that tax break. What happened was it freed up the tax, that capital to move. So what happened was I was working at the Ford plant in Pico Rivera at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They said, okay, well, Ford said, look, we can go ahead and pay the 28%, which is more than we're paying now because we're avoiding that tax by reinvesting. So they stopped reinvesting in the United States and in the Ford plants here in this country. They went ahead and built in Mexico and other places. Reagan removed the tariffs. Then they shut the Ford plant down and went away, but it didn't free up anything. It just freed it up to leave, or it didn't create any. It just freed it up to leave.
Right.
So that's what happened. So that's why revenues went up. It didn't go up because there was this big, massive increase in profits. There wasn't. They just reinvested overseas, knowing in the long term they wouldn't have to pay any taxes.
Right.
And then jobs were created, and that very Ford plant opened back up as a Northrop Grumman plant because of Reagan's phony threat from the Soviet Union and his big tripling of the national debt and his big buildup.
So
he's standing there while the Soviet Union collapses of its own rotten weight and yells timber and gets credit for that too.
Right. Yeah.
So Dan is out of his freaking mind.
Okay, Robert. Thank you. Durwood in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Hey, Durwood, what's up?
Hi. Your book, Scrooge, should be reading in all social studies. Oh, they canceled them under Reagan.
Well, thank you, Durwood.
The points made before also should include workers' compensation and unemployment, the increase in taxes on those.
But
when you talk about the traitorous Republicans, I think we need to look back at the Republican history, starting back with the Teapot Dome scandal, the trying to buy the election to keep Roosevelt, the first Teddy, from running, the attempted coup under FDR, the Nixon traitorous with the Vietnamese, and then Reagan himself with the Iranians. This whole meme that the Republicans have of undermining and attacking progressive, either progressive presidents for Teddy Roosevelt, but just Democratic in general, has a long history that has to be counted with their latest effort with the 47.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Thank you, Durwood, for that. I'm with you. Joe in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I'd like to respond to that guest because I don't think he thinks people who were alive then are still alive today. I remember three distinct things that caused that economy to boom. Number one, interest rates. Paul Volcker reduced those rates from like a prime rate of 17% to, I don't know, 6%, which, you know, ended up making everything a lot cheaper, cars, houses, the whole thing. Number two, and I was a military officer at the time and also in grad school and business school at night, military spending. I had a front row seat to that, and we just totally blew that out of the water.
Yeah.
So that had a Keynesian, a stimulus effect.
Yep.
And number three, the baby boomers were having kids. And you need houses and cars and baby carriages and baby food and all that other stuff. And those are at least, I mean, the tax cuts probably had some impact, but not compared to those three.
Yeah.
Those three were huge.
I'm with you. And the one thing that you probably could track back to the tax cut is the giant recession that we had. And again, I would argue that that the economy gets fragile and cyclical when there's too much hot money running around in it, and that that hot money would be, you know, what comes as a result of tax cuts. People are just, you know, hey, I've got more money than I thought I did. Oh, I need to invest it quick. You know, let's go for some high risk investments. And then boom, you know, the market falls apart. But Joe, excellent points all. Thank you for that. Dave in South Range, Michigan. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Getting back to your debate with Dan Bongino, he failed to point out that the fact that the revenues went up under Reagan was because the tax burden was shifted right from the wealthy down to the working class. We paid more in Social Security and Medicare and federal income wages out of our paychecks.
Yep.
And that's where the revenues came from.
Yeah. Yeah, and he doubled. He literally doubled the tax, the Social Security tax. Excellent point. There's, yeah, and to federal revenue as well. Thank you for that, Dave. Good one. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, you think I'm being too principled?
Yeah, well, just a quickie. He also raised taxes 11 times when he realized his tax cuts were not so smart.
Right. Although raised taxes on working people, he maintained tax cuts on rich people.
Right. Yeah, I talked to you about this before, and I still insist we have to have what I would like to call the IRS Lettergazi hearings. IRS standing for Ignorant Republican Senators.
Hmm.
We have to have hearings. We got to dirty these people up.
Yeah.
Because they will do it to us any chance they get.
The problem is we don't control the House or the Senate, so we don't have a venue for hearings right now, Howard.
Yeah, well, then I asked you about the Justice Department. And they
right.
can't just hold a hearing. It has to be
no.
a prosecution.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the criminal justice department. You know, it's not the – it's, you know, the legislature can do it and say, you know, we're looking into this because we might want to write a law about this. Or we're looking into this because we need to inform ourselves about this topic. The executive branch can't make that excuse. They have to say, you know, we're looking into this because we're thinking of sending this guy to jail. And once you've said that out loud, all kinds of things happen that get very, very strange. You know, it's like what Thomas Jefferson said about slavery. You know, it's taking a wolf by the ears. Howard, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day, and eventually Bob Ney will drop by with the Talk Radio News Service. And welcome back. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to say my wife's too timid to say this on the air, but... I think it's kind of more like a Madame Lafarge sort of attitude that she has, but she thinks that they're, you know, off with their heads, that they've committed treason and they should pay the ultimate price. And I think that, you know, compared to, say, like what the Rosenbergs did, and since this does have to do with nuclear weapons, I think that's kind of germane to the conversation, but, you know, they had to pay the ultimate price, and maybe they were passing secrets to the Soviet Union, but they were actually doing real work. It takes a lot of work to be a nuclear physicist and to do what they did at Los Alamos Labs. And these people are doing nothing but destructive kind of work. I mean, it's Obamacare, it's this, his foreign policy. Whatever he does, they're subverting this government. And I don't agree with her. I don't think it's treasonous necessarily. But I think it's pretty damn nasty, and we need to do something about it, and,
yeah.
you know, more than just talk about it. But
yep.
anyway, that's all.
I'm with you, John. I'm with you. And this is something that's worth calling every single member, you know, both of your senators and you know, opining about. John, thank you for the call. Jay, watching Free Speech TV in Murfreesboro, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just want to make comments about unions. And
mm-hmm.
What a lot of people don't realize is that when there were no unions and the coal miners fought and died on the mountaintop and got gunned down and on the courthouse steps, they were working for the company store.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have any rights, and they bought all their food from the coal mines, and they paid rent. They were working as slaves. They had no rights. And they paved the way for a lot of even non-working people that have rights like health care, paid vacation time, women's rights, and just rights that people take for granted every day. And we have all these union-busting Republicans, governors, that, like Scott Walker, and in our state here, our newly elected Governor Bruce Rauner, that's taking the tack on unions, and all these right-to-work states that they're trying to come up with. That's a right to work for nothing or slavery and have
right.
no rights at all.
Right to work for less is what they should call it.
Yes, or even... Or right to be unemployed and have your jobs replaced. Right. And I'm a 40-year union man, and I've tried to, do my part. People think that the union workers make too much money. I don't know why that people are against unions when a lot of their benefits that they have now.
Yeah. Yeah, what's astonishing to me, Jay, is how somebody like Grover Norquist, who probably makes hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million a year, is, or multiple millions, has been so successful at getting people who make $20,000 or $30,000 a year to hate people who make $40,000 or $50,000 a year because they have a union. And it's like, these guys making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year are succeeding in getting, people close to the minimum wage. It's astonishing to hate unionized workers. Jay, thanks for the call. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person or Hobby Lobby or any? No, we dare to say no, not a chance. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world today. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. And with us today, Bob Ney. Hey, Congressman, how are you?
Hi, Tom. I'm filling in for Victoria today.
Okay, great. And I should say, author of Sideswiped, the book on how D.C. works. So, Congressman, what's going on in the world?
Well, Tom, there's three major things. The first two in Congress. One goes towards the debt ceiling, and we reach it today, actually, the $18 trillion, which means the Treasury is going to have to start to find ways to come up with money to fund the government. It'll be basically catastrophic by October or November, so we'll see if there'll be a fight. Under the Bush administration, there were six different debt ceiling raises that had occurred with no problem, but of course we know when it came down to President Obama, it all of a sudden became an issue. So I don't know if the Republicans will do that run again. They let it go last time, but we'll see. Now they're having their own internal fight in the other part of the debt talks today, because the hawks in the Republican side, and of course they're controlling the budget now, are fighting against the military people in the Republican conference. So they're having kind of an argument of who spends the money when, and the hawks want to set some different type of markers, we call them, for the debt ceilings in these bills themselves.
Hmm.
Now this spending measure, by the way, it's filibuster proof. It's not a real piece of legislation. It's a spending statement, we'll call it, Tom. So it just needs simple vote, doesn't need the cloture vote in the Senate, the 60 votes, and it doesn't have to have up against a filibuster.
So it's not so much a budget as a statement of priorities?
That's right. It's more of a statement of priorities, and it goes around the process.
So when does the budget come out?
Well, the budget's going to be due by it has to be finished by October the 1st, but the budget should be in process now. This is the first part, the budget document. Then the actual work is done by the appropriation committees of the House and the Senate. So we're going to see a lot of internal fighting, frankly, amongst Republicans even before it gets to the Democratic side. And the second thing going on in the Congress is something that's actually, I think, amazingly unprecedented, in which Senator Trey Gowdy, who heads up the Select Benghazi Committee, and he's a Republican from South Carolina, Tom, as we know, yesterday on the Sunday show said that the House as an institution may go to court. Now, this is a brand new thing created by the Republicans of suing the president. Maybe they'll sue each other at some point in time. but he's talking actually about going to court for Hillary Clinton's private emails.
Oh, yeah.
Now, as the Democratic side has pointed out, she has offered to come to the committee. She has offered to turn over the emails. So now this would really be an unprecedented step for the House as an institution to sue Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be amazing.
But nothing amazes me anymore. I'm sorry.
Well, this is actually so unprecedented. And by the way, when Congressman Gowdy, and I just want to just talk a brief second of history here, when he talks about the fact that they're not after whether she was picking out gowns for her daughter's wedding or yoga is what he said, they're not after that. Well, if you look at what happened when Dan Burton with the Select Committee, he actually used private conversations that Webb Hubble had with his family in prison and released those over the Internet. So no one can say if somebody goes into somebody's private email that it won't end up somewhere in the front page of some newspaper or on some radio broadcast.
Well, that's interesting.
And
what was the content of Webb Hubble's private conversations that was being released?
Frankly, it was talks with his daughter about some medical problems she had. And they made a decision, which they were not supposed to release those tapes. No one in this country has those tapes released when they call their homes, but they were released on Webb Hubble. So I'm just pointing out, when they say, well, we're not after those personal things, well, that wasn't the case in the past, and nobody can assure
that.
Was that
Ken Starr and company who were doing that?
Yes, sir, it was. Well, actually, they all had access to the tapes. It was Dan Burton and the Select Committee that eventually made a decision to release them in the interest of something.
So as a member of Congress? Oh, okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, therefore, if they sue as an institution, somebody goes after the private emails and they start to look through all of them, nobody can guarantee that anyone's private emails, which have nothing to do with anything of the Secretary of State's office, would not end up somewhere.
Right.
I mean, there's some past history for that. And the third issue out there, which is amazing, too, is the unprecedented letter continues to draw a lot of fire from the senators. Now, it's defended by Mitch McConnell, the head of the Senate for the Republicans. But many members on that letter are starting to backtrack, including John McCain, for signing it. And now it has made negotiations just a little bit more difficult because the conservative Ayatollahs in Iran are actually thanking the Republican senators for giving them enough fuel for fodder to be able to say this is not a good agreement. After all, it's not going to be, quote, approved by the Senate. So it's made the negotiations a bit more intense. And President Obama just spoke out and actually made the statement that he was amazed that these people in the Senate who consider the right-wing neocon Ayatollahs to be enemies of America, they actually cooperated with them by providing this letter.
Yeah. What do you think of one of these retired generals, Paul Eaton? He said this isn't treason, this is mutiny, which is pretty bad.
Well, Tom, it's unprecedented. Now, they can say that people went and met with, you know, foreign leaders, Nancy Pelosi with Assad. Rumsfeld went and met with, obviously, if we look back in history, met with Saddam Hussein. A meeting with an official is a different story than a person going over and saying, by the way, why don't you oppose our government? That's
right.
A whole different story.
Yeah,
and these senators are backtracking from this letter because they know they made a huge error.
Yeah, here's what Major General Paul D. Eaton said, quote, I would use the word mutinous. I do not believe these senators are trying to sell out America. I do believe they defied the chain of command in what could be construed as an illegal act.
Oh, I think if somebody wanted to press the Logan Act on this one, and the Logan Act is, you know, really never used, and I understand that, and it's an old act, but if you really read the Logan Act and somebody really wanted to press this, I think there would be some senators sweating over this one. This is pretty unprecedented in American history of signing this exact pointed type of letter to a foreign leader to sabotage just discussions by our own country.
To the best of my knowledge, nothing like this has ever happened.
That's
Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
Check out Bob's book, Sideswipe. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Banks say thanks for the bailout. Now, this is pretty astonishing. I mean, we're talking about the perfidy of Republican lawmakers, 47 traitors. The perfidy of Republican businesses is pretty bad, too. And arguably even worse, they're not always entirely Republican businesses. In the case of Wall Street, they own a lot of Democrats, too. Senator Sanders commissioned a report which found that the four big banks basically, N2Doc posted this over at Democratic Underground this morning. I'm not sure if this is a copy and paste from Bernie's website or whether it's from allgov.com. But anyhow, here's what it says. Citigroup got the most help of the four in the bailout, $2.5 trillion. That company has at least 427 offshore divisions where it squirrels away profits out of the reach of the American people. Those funds, as of early 2014, totaled $43 billion, which would mean $11 billion in tax revenue for the United States if they had deposited that money in the United States. Citigroup CEO Michael Corbett was rewarded with $1.5 million in salary, $4.5 million in bonuses, and $8 million in stock. This is how it always plays out. They get most of their money in stock because that's the lowest tax rate. This used to be illegal before the Reagan administration. Bank of America received a $1.3 trillion bailout from the American people. In 2014, it had $17 billion in profits stashed offshore, which would bring $4.3 billion to the United States if they paid taxes in the United States on their money. It would bring $4.5 billion for education, infrastructure, and other badly needed products. CEO of Bank of America, Brian Moynihan, made $1.5 million in salary, $13 million in bonuses, $11.5 million in stock last year. There's another interesting piece. Katrina Vandenhoevel over at the Washington Post and at Katrina Nation at the Nation magazine, thenation.com. Says, my take this morning, Martin O'Malley sounds like he's running and why competitive Democratic primary season is important. Martin O'Malley, I'm just curious. I just toss this open for you to call in and respond. Martin O'Malley, the Democratic former governor of Maryland, the former mayor of Baltimore, a reasonably progressive Democrat. While there's all this hysteria about Hillary Clinton's emails, at least hysteria on the right, Martin O'Malley is basically traveling around. He's gone to Kansas, New Hampshire, Iowa. He's delivering a progressive populist message. He's called for reinstating Glass-Steagall, for jacking the capital gains tax back up to where ordinary income is, to increasing the minimum wage, to raising the threshold for overtime pay, to strengthening collective bargaining rights. He said, quote, triangulation is not a strategy that will move America forward, speaking of the Clinton strategy of accomplishing things politically. the old Clinton policy. You know, whether this is the Clinton policy going forward, God only knows. But, you know, triangulation. He says, we have to be very clear as a party about our principles. He said, I think we need, this is Katrina Vandenheuvel talking about Martin O'Malley. And my question to you is, do you know about Martin O'Malley? Would you vote for Martin O'Malley? Should Martin O'Malley challenge Hillary Clinton in a primary or not? There are those who suggest that because Teddy Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter in a primary, now Carter was the sitting president, Hillary Clinton is not the sitting president, but you get the point. Because, they say, because Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. Carter lost to Reagan because Reagan had cut a deal with the Ayatollahs to keep the hostages. And in exchange for keeping the hostages until the day that Reagan was sworn in January of 1981, in exchange for that, the Reagan campaign said, we will sell you spare parts for the American-owned military that you have, or the American-manufactured military that you have, that the Shah had bought all this stuff. And, you know, we'll sell you this stuff. So anyhow, the argument has been made, don't primary a candidate because it'll weaken them. Might be true. In fact, almost certainly is true. But does it mean that it is a bad idea to have a primary? I think not. I think having a primary gives an opportunity for all the issues to get out, for the issues to be laid on the table, for people to talk about things. Martin O'Malley says, and I quote, we have to be very clear as a party about our principles. I think we undercut our own governing message and our own mission of statement when we're not clear-throated about the failure of trickle-down economics, how the economy is a result of political choices we make, and why we need a combination of wage policies that reward work and policies to rein in reckless speculation that becomes destructive or predatory. It just undercuts our argument when we try to find the middle ground. There's Martin O'Malley saying, I'm not in the middle. I'm the progressive here. He's clearly challenging Hillary Clinton. Or is he running for vice president? Are we going to end up with a Clinton-O'Malley ticket? By the way, if we end up with a Walker-Bush ticket on the Republican side, there's a lot of us who remember George Herbert Walker Bush. And the new ticket will be Walker Bush? Really? That's if Jeb ran for vice president. Keep in mind, Scott Walker is he's the fair-haired boy of the Koch brothers. So he is going to rocket to the top. And because all of this money, this $1 billion that the Koch brothers are raising, is all going to go to radio and television stations, they're never going to mention the fact that Scott Walker is there with Koch money. They're never going to mention the fact that Scott Walker is there exclusively because of Koch money. They're never going to mention the fact that Scott Walker is still governor of Wisconsin, largely because of Koch money. This guy's a Kochhead. You know, Wisconsin has a Koch problem. It's not just Wisconsin, it's most of the country. So anyhow, would you vote for Martin O'Malley? He says, there's been a myth pushed that what's wrong with our country is entitlements. He says, I do think we need to expand Social Security. I think we need to be unabashed about it. I think that people have been responding to Senator Warren because of the clarity with which she speaks to the rigging of the system. And when he was governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley passed marriage equality in his state, got it through the legislature. He banned assault weapons in Maryland. He ended the death penalty in Maryland. He raised the minimum wage, put into place a state version of the DREAM Act. I mean, this guy is like, you know, if I was going to create a Democratic politician and say, okay, here's my presidential ticket, this would be it. That said, I got to say, I live in Washington, D.C., and so I, to the extent that I pay attention to local politics, I do read the local section of the Washington Post, and I have some sense of what's going on in my town. But I don't know Maryland politics that much. I've never met Martin O'Malley. I don't think I've ever talked with him. Maybe he's been a guest on our program, and I just don't remember it, but I don't think so. What do you know about this guy? Would you vote for him? Do you think that the Democratic Party should be entertaining, you know, basically a primary? We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with your calls. And welcome back. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, real quick, ixnay on the fact that we have free places to go like the Museum of Natural History and the Smithsonian. Don't bring that to their attention because they'll either privatize it or they'll have the people from the Noah's Ark theme park go down there and install exhibits.
You're right. Actually, Johnny, they've already partially privatized them. All of the gift shops and all of the various Smithsonians have been privatized out to private corporations that pay their employees crap wages, basically.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, don't tempt them because they love to micromanage, even though they're the party of little government. They love telling the people of Washington, D.C., oh, you can't pass laws, especially when it's something we don't like. So
right.
Don't tempt them. They got their plate full of corruption right now.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I would have had a question for your guest earlier.
Dan Bongino.
Dan Bongino, the former Secret Service agent and NYPD. I don't know what the NYPD means, if he was
a street cop
or a lieutenant or whatever. But
no, he was a street cop. I know Dan. I mean, I don't know him well or personally, but he's been on my TV show a lot of times, and I've spent a fair amount of time talking with him. He's a reasonable fellow.
He sounded really reasonable today, Tom.
Yeah,
he really thinks he's qualified to run for Senate. I wonder what he would think of someone like Serpico running against him for the Senate. You know, what is his position on the RICO statute, for example?
Mm.
What does he feel about his party's inability to get into office without having to engage in voter intimidation and voter suppression and gerrymandering voting districts and going behind the backs of acting U.S. presidents, making deals with foreign governments like the Vietnamese in the 60s or the Iranians in the 1950s and again in the 1970s?
Right. 1980 specifically. Yes, I'm with you, Johnny. And, you know, I don't know how Dan would respond to that, but go ahead, Johnny.
One other thing. I'd like to know what his feelings are about the current situation with the Secret Service, particularly that supervisor that's been talked about on MSNBC quite a bit. If you have a look at the photographs of this guy at various points the past year or two, that guy does not look like a happy camper. Now, I don't know if it's the fact that their detail is demoralized by the politics or the defunding, or if it's the result of being resentful of having to take a bullet for a black guy. We all know that there's a big conservative tradition in the military and Secret Service, so
yeah.
There's that to consider.
Yeah, I know we've had on this program a couple of times the fellow from Chicago who was the first black Secret Service detail member. He was Jack Kennedy's Secret Service guy. I'm forgetting his name right off the top of my head, but Abraham Bolden. Thank you, Shano. Abraham Bolden called out the Secret Service for being drunk in Dallas with Jack Kennedy and ended up himself going to jail for squealing out, you know, the Secret Service guys for being drunk women chasers. And
yeah, I'm aware of that, but the weird thing, Tom, is that all these things with the Secret Service, it's just too much. It's too much in a little bit of time.
Yeah.
It's very unnatural.
I think it's all of the above, Johnny. I think that your diagnosis is right. I think that A, they're looking at budget cuts. B, they're looking at, you know, historically misogynistic and racist, basically white power culture in this town. And now they've got a black president. I think you're right. Johnny, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes after the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Matt in Cortez, Colorado. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
I'm going to try to avoid a rant here, but this frustrated me to no end earlier. constantly accusing the Democratic Party of wanting the government to fix things for them, of wanting the government to give something for them. What we want is for your party to quit taking from the public dole to give it to the super rich.
Really? Who are...
Ronald Reagan, his famous most terrifying 9 words. At this point, the most terrifying 17 words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help the super rich become the new landed gentry.
Right. Okay. So your point is that the libertarians and the Republicans are on the side of a government that is helping the rich. Yeah, okay.
Well, the accusation that we want something for free. No, we just want to be free to not have our things stolen unfairly and have the back against us.
Yeah, we've seen a $30 trillion transfer of wealth since the Reagan administration from the working class in the United States to the top 1%. It is astonishing. Matt, I got it. Thank you very much. Good point. Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason.
Hello,
Reaganomics?
Yeah, I think that term is too benign and too kind. You know, thinking about that, it's a combination of the words Reagan and economics. I think we should call it Reconomics.
Ha! Reconomics. That's a good one. That's a very good one. Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening in Chicago. Jeff in Albuquerque. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to comment on what you had asked earlier about whether I would vote for Martin O'Malley.
For president, yeah.
Yeah, and my answer is unequivocally yes. You know, as a lifelong progressive Democrat, I get really tired of my party moving towards the center to chase some sort of voter, which is really never going to come to our side on any important issue.
Yeah.
So Jim Webb and people like Martin O'Malley, for me, they're a breath of fresh air. And even if they can't win in the general, I want those ideas out there, and I want those ideas discussed.
Yeah. I wouldn't put Jim Webb and Martin O'Malley in the same category. I mean, Jim Webb is sort of a prairie populist. He's one of these kind of conservatives, whereas Martin O'Malley looks to me like an actual progressive Democrat. Am I missing something?
No, I'm inclined to agree with you, but when the National Journal, I believe it was, put out a really lengthy article where they interviewed Jim Webb, I was actually pleasantly surprised by a lot of his policies because they seem to be based on a common sense understanding that most of the lower and middle classes have a lot more in common than they do really in opposition to each other.
Right.
And I think that's something that gets lost a lot in the messaging these days.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, that's the real message. Jeff, thanks for the call. Cynthia in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Cynthia, you want to talk about Martin O'Malley?
How are you?
Cynthia, are you with us?
I'm here. Sorry about that. Technical difficulties.
Okay. What's up?
Yeah, I am a very progressive as well, and I really do like Martin O'Malley. I just think he would be a great president, but I think that we should let him feed Hillary's vice at this point, and then after they have their reign, then he can take over as president.
Do you know how old he is by any chance?
I would say he's late 40s, early 50s, and I really think he's more in his 40s, but I'm not, don't quote me on that.
Shano just checked it out. He's 52 years old, so that would be great if he was vice president.
Yeah, I just think that, like you said, primarying, I think, is going to be not good for Hillary, and I think she's just got the best chance right now, even though, again, she's not as progressive as I would like. But let a woman be president, and then let Martin O'Malley, let's just keep the Democrats in office as long as possible.
Yeah, I'm with you, Cynthia. That makes perfect sense to me. Thank you for the call. Kent in Henderson, Arkansas. Hey, Kent, you've got some Arkansas information?
Yes, I do. The Arkansas State Legislature is floating a bill right now that would let Senator Tom Coke Cotton be a standing senator and run for president in 2020. The current law didn't allow that.
Really? Is that because 2020 he's up for re-election?
That'd be the next presidential election, I guess.
Right. Yeah, you got 2016 and then 2020.
The law right now says you can't be a senator and run for president. And they asked him if he was interested in running. He said, no, I'm not interested, but the state legislature is going ahead, and it's passed the state senate, and it's on its way to the House right now.
Wow. Do you figure, Kent, I mean, you live in Arkansas, do you figure that this is more just Arkansas Republicans kind of doing some chest pounding and saying, hey, yeah, we're with our guy. You know, he's under attack from the Democrats. We're going to stand up for him. Do you think it was that?
I talked to a state legislator when we still had a few Democrats a few years back. He said you wouldn't believe the amount of Coke people that were there pressing them to pass stuff all the time.
Yeah. The Koch brothers are fairly ubiquitous in Republican circles. Ken, thank you for the call. Fascinating stuff. Henry in San Jose, California. Hey, Henry, you wanted to respond to Dan Bongino?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Henry.
You know these this guy, Dan?
Yeah.
The Reagan worshippers, they never cease to amaze me. They always bring up the Reagan economy. But I always hit him with a few points. They ignore everything but the damage he did, like the assault on unions, assault on the working class, national debt, rise in the homeless, and also the national debt.
Yeah.
On every president after World War II, except when it got to Reagan, then it started going up.
Yep.
So... you know, they forget about all of that.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter actually submitted a balanced budget, something Reagan never did. Yeah.
And you hit up with the Clinton increased taxes, and we had a booming economy.
Yep.
So how do they reconcile that?
Right, and Bush cut taxes, and the economy went in the tank, and then Obama came in and raised taxes, and the economy came back again. So... you know, shouldn't this tell us something? Excellent point, Henry. Thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius. We'll be back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
So should Martin O'Malley launch a primary against Hillary, or should he simply come out and say, hey, I'd like to be your vice presidential candidate, or none of the above? You know, I've said it over and over and over again. I'll continue saying it. There are only two kinds of people in the Republican Party. There are rich people and there are suckers. And the suckers don't get it, that they're taking all these positions that only benefit rich people. And they keep taking those positions. Now, some of the positions, some of the Republican positions, arguably don't benefit rich people. Let's talk about Christianity, for example. How would it benefit rich people that Christians had more political power in the United States than less? Well, it turns out, actually, there is a way that it could benefit rich people. In fact, rich people started this process back in the 30s and 40s in the United States. There's a great op-ed about this in the New York Times from the weekend about America as a Christian nation. And it points out that it was the efforts of the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who brought Billy Graham together with capitalism. And Billy Graham became this outspoken proponent of a Christian capitalism, which led in the 1950s to our putting God in our coins, to putting God in our Pledge of Allegiance, to putting God as our national slogan. All this God stuff happened in the 1950s as a consequence of the largest business group in this country deciding that they were going to bring in Billy Graham and his Christian followers as long as they preached Christian libertarianism, which they have been doing and they continue to do to this day. So from the rich guy's point of view, Billy Graham is the entryway, the doorway into the suckers. Right. Let's bring the suckers into the party, because, you know, if your party is, hey, we're here for the 1%, you're never going to get more than 1% of the vote. And you got to have 51% of the vote to win elections. So what do Republicans do? Well, they say, OK, economically, we're only here for the 1%. But we had to bring along these other people. We've got to reach into the pool of suckers and bring them along. And so we'll get the abortion suckers, and we'll get the lower tax suckers, and we'll get the I hate immigrants suckers, and we'll get the racist suckers, and we'll get the people who really just don't understand economics suckers. And they just, you know, they go through, oh, and the people who are, you know, you're going to have to take their gun from their cold, dead fingers, those suckers, we'll take them. And they build what they call a coalition. Amazing. Anyhow, Martin O'Malley, Judy in Mount Joy, Pennsylvania. Hey, Judy, you had some thoughts on Martin O'Malley?
Yes, I've been kind of reading about him. So, yes, I did hear about him, and I know who he is, and I think he's a great progressive. But here's my thought. As a woman of a certain age, Hillary's age, a lot of women I know, progressive women like myself, we want a woman before we die. It's just that simple.
Yep.
Now, would I vote for a Republican woman? No. But I think Hillary is not nearly as conservative in all as some people seem to think. In my view, I think it's kind of sexist, but, you know, they attribute anything Bill did to Hillary, and I don't think that's fair.
Yep.
I think she's more malleable than that. I think the ideal ticket would be, for me, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but I'm also a pragmatist. That's not going to happen, and I think most of us know that. I can see a Hillary Clinton with Martin O'Malley as a vice president. One thing I'll say about Hillary that us progressives seem to forget, Hillary was really, really knows the game that the right plays and doesn't have to learn that game.
Right. Well, this is where
Obama, I voted for Obama, and I love him, but honestly, I think he wasted a lot of years on trying to work with this Republican Congress.
I agree. This is the thing that President Obama, what President Obama did not know when he became president, is how to take names and kick ass, how to use power. I'm talking major power, big power. President Obama had never had big power in his life. He was a senator only for a few months before he decided to run for president, and never really, in my opinion, for at least the first few years of his presidency, and maybe even just until this year, never really understood how to wield power. I think he's getting it. I think he's getting better at it.
I think he sincerely believed, and my big thing to my friends when in 2008 was my worry. Mm-hmm. As a progressive, my first choice was Edwards, and I was really wrong on that, but I thought Hillary and Clinton were very similar, but I said I picked Hillary in the primary for one reason, that I did not think she would ever be fooled by the right again.
Right. Yeah.
And Obama, I think, and I don't want to say fooled because he's a very brilliant man, but I do think he sincerely thought he could bring them over.
Oh, I agree. I think he read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book and thought, hey, if Abe Lincoln can do this, I can do this. And Abe Lincoln got killed for his efforts, by the way, and his vice president, who was of the opposite party, Andrew Johnson, was a Democrat, basically tried to reverse the course of the country after the Civil War. It was a real mess. And I wish he had read, instead of reading Band of Brothers, I wish he had read, Harvey Kay's book about FDR or something. But Judy, I got to move along. But thank you for the call. Lee in Reading, Connecticut. Hey, Lee, thanks for listening.
Oh, how's it going, man?
Good. Martin O'Malley?
Yeah, I would just think it's not Martin O'Malley specifically as much as any time anyone other than Hillary Clinton is mentioned, they're always shunted to the vice president or they can't win. Even people talking about Bernie Sanders, it seems like the first thing a lot of liberals say is, well, it'd be great to have him in. The discussion has opened up to new topics, but we know he can't be president. With people.
Yeah. Lee, your phone is breaking up pretty badly. Here's the question that I think most pragmatic progressives have. We no longer live in a democratic republic. We now live in an oligarchy. And the oligarchs have lined up on the right. The Koch brothers have committed to raise almost $1 billion. Their man is Scott Walker. I think that means that there's a relatively high probability that Scott Walker is going to be on the ticket, president or vice president, on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it's also going to take $1 billion or $2 billion to run for president. Who other than Hillary Clinton has access to that kind of money?
Well, I don't know, but you
you're in your sign-offs about getting voting, getting involved, stuff. I mean, none of that really requires money. You say, you seem to think that that's the key to, you know, like if we had the numbers,
yeah,
the money wouldn't necessarily matter as much. So what my question was, I guess, when the phone was breaking up is, if every liberal that says Sanders can't win, voted Sanders, like...
Yeah. Lee, I'm sorry, Lee, you're breaking up. I couldn't make out the question, but thank you for the call. We'll have to try it another time. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You were saying that the Republican Party is now either millionaires or suckers.
Right.
Yeah, Mike Papantonio said it a little differently. He said now the Republican Party is just a bunch of lunatics or grifters.
Yeah.
Lunatics and grifters.
Well, yeah. I would like to allow them to keep a little more self-respect. Although I guess, you know, rich people and suckers isn't...
But it's not really the people who vote for them, maybe the millionaires and suckers.
Yeah.
The people, the elected people are kind of lunatics and grifters.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that characterization. So, Anita, your thoughts on Martin O'Malley?
Yeah, I like Martin O'Malley. I really do. But I think we have to think pragmatically. And I think that who I'm hoping Hillary Clinton would pick would be Julian Castro.
The mayor of San Antonio or his brother?
He was the mayor of San Antonio, yes.
Oh, and he's now in Obama's cabinet.
Yes, he's the twin.
Right.
And I just think that we need to get, you know, Hispanics out as much as we can. And I know in Texas he's very, very popular.
Yeah, you're right. And that's Texas. That's the southern state. That's a big state.
Exactly. And we have so little voter participation within the Hispanic community here.
Right.
They would come out for him.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, with, you know, Obama and, you know, we got the black vote and.
Yeah.
It's, I really think that. You know,
Julian, J-U-L-I-A-N.
Yes, J-U-L-I-N.
So.
Castro.
Julian Castro, right?
He has a twin brother. Yeah.
Yeah, he has a twin brother who's in Congress. Isn't he?
Yeah, Joaquin.
Yeah, Joaquin. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's representative.
Yeah. Anita, thank you for that. Thanks for the information. That's a good suggestion, Julian Castro. Audrey in Rancho Cucamonga, California. Hey, Audrey, got a minute. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Here's my thing. If we could get Hillary to the night, let me mute that. Sorry, I'm trying to watch traffic. If we could... get Hillary took in 1975, I would do handsprings all the way to ballot box. But the Hillary of today, I think, is very conservative. And while I did agree with the previous caller who said that she knows how to kick ass and take names, and I agree with that, you know, I voted for, being an ardent feminist, I voted for Obama rather than Clinton because I thought, wrongly as it turns out, that he wasn't as conservative as she was. I think they're both pretty conservative, and I think that if we don't find a way to move the conversation to the left clearly and consistently in the way that Elizabeth Warren does, speaking plain English that people understand what she's saying, I think if we don't do that, then we're going to run what is essentially a moderate Republican against the lunatic in the general.
Yeah, and the lunatic will win. I'm very concerned about that also, Audrey. Thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, would you vote for Martin O'Malley for president? What do you think? We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave watching Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin via Roku. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, I listen to your show every single day, all 3 hours, and I'm glad that I have Free Speech TV, so that will never change.
Indeed.
I've heard some people say things today about Hillary that, you know, they want a woman president, and that's fine, and they think maybe it's Hillary's turn, and I even heard somebody say that we should just let Hillary be president and Martin O'Malley be vice president because he'll be young and he can take over. But I don't want to let anybody be president because it's their turn or because of any other reason. I want to vote for someone I think is going to make a good president. And I think Hillary has too many fascistic tendencies.
For example?
Well, she's a bait-and-switch Democrat. She will say one thing to get elected and do another thing, exactly the same as Obama has done, exactly the same as Clinton has done. Clinton did when he was president. And we've got to get away from this. We've got to, as the last caller said, we have to find some way to change the dialogue in this country so that people can hear what, you know, actual ideas are floating around in the country that are so vastly different from what the Democratic Party is willing to give to us. And so I think she's just going to be another establishment fascist.
So, therefore, we should just say screw it and go home and let a Republican win?
No, I'm saying Martin O'Malley or whoever else wants to run had better run, and they'd better run for president and not vice president.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be a good, if there is any reality to the meme that's being floated that Hillary Clinton is kind of the inevitable Democratic candidate? If there's any truth to that, and I think there's considerable truth to that, then isn't it incumbent upon us who are concerned about and probably would vote for the Democratic candidate to do or say whatever we can to help move that candidate to a position that agrees with ours?
I don't think that we need to lie, if that's what you're suggesting.
I'm not. I would never suggest lying.
I didn't think that you were, but... No, I don't think that I don't think we should do or say anything to get elected and then run your administration in a totally different way. We're seeing that here in Wisconsin with Scott Walker,
right,
where he just plain did not say both times, you know, and I say never underestimate the stupidity of the American public. Richard Nixon won twice on a promise to end the war in Vietnam.
Right, which he was actively working behind the scenes to continue.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So we've got to get away from that, and that means we have to have a large primary. You know, I don't think any elected official from dog catcher on up should ever not be primaried.
Yeah. Dave, in principle, I completely agree with you. And it's our system has just become so corrupted with cash that we have to be having this conversation. It's really unfortunate. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Aaron in Albuquerque. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. So I really agree with that call you had from Wisconsin just now. I think it's really important we get a primary in. Whether or not we have Hillary, which, you know, I'm not a big fan of the establishment Democrats, but I think that even if we do have a primary and she gets eventually elected, we'll do so much more to bring her more to the left because she'll have to be vying for those progressive votes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a lot better for the party and a lot better for visibility as well to have a big primary, whether it's Elizabeth Warren running against her or...
that was the Republican strategy the last time around, and it didn't work out all that well for them. Of course, on the other hand, if you're running as a Republican, you basically have to lie to people about your agenda. If you're running as a Democrat, you can choose to lie about your agenda, but you don't have to. So yeah,
they also had the unfortunate situation of running against an incumbent.
Yeah,
because John Kerry had the same problem running against George Bush.
Yeah,
so I, you know, with a nice big open office again, I think that a primary is not going to be too detrimental because we had a big primary before 2008.
Yeah,
and that's how Hillary Clinton went from being the eventual president to Barack Obama becoming the front runner and our president.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. Okay. Good point, Aaron. We'll see how this shakes out. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. Concerning Martin O'Malley, not to correct you, but a quote that you read from him that saying that entitlements may be an issue. I don't know exactly what the quote was, but and then he referred to Social Security, and I have to correct that language. Social Security is not an entitlement.
Right.
Social Security is an earned benefit. I want to talk about what you mentioned about Ronald Reagan and Social Security, but first I want to give a plug for me. For those of you listening in the Seattle area, I will be giving a talk, holding a public forum on Social Security on March 28th, Saturday, March 28th at 2 o'clock at the Kirkland Library,
Okay.
from 2 to 4 p.m. in the meeting room at the Kirkland Library. I'll call again next week to remind people, but I'd like to have listeners in the Seattle area, Seattle, Bellevue, Kirkland, Woodinville area come and Bothell.
Cool. Paul, send me an email about that, and I'll ask Sue to put it into the newsletter, and we'll promote it.
Great. Thanks. Ronald Reagan raised payroll taxes, FICA taxes, in 1986, and the idea was to cover the baby boomers. And Ronald Reagan said, well, we're going to guarantee that all the guarantees of Social Security for the next 50 years as they were in the past half century. Okay, if we raise the payroll taxes, we raised to 6.2% for Social Security and Medicare. How now is it the Republicans are claiming that Social Security is insolvent? And you know why, Tom? Because
they want to privatize.
They want to privatize. They're saying it's insolvent because once the bonds are issued into the Social Security Trust Fund, the money that pays for them, your FICA taxes, go into the general treasury, indistinguishable from every other dollar. And then what happens? It gets spent. It was about 10 years ago this year when I just about went to distraction to hear George W. Bush say when he wanted to privatize Social Security that Social Security by 2025 will be paying out $325 billion more than it takes in. Guess what the price tag on the Iraq war was at that time?
Less
$325 billion.
Yeah.
You know why? Because when the Treasury has to pay these bonds, these Treasury bonds back, these special issue Treasury bonds to the Social Security Trust Fund, they have to have money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't raise taxes to pay for your war, then Social Security becomes part of the budget, and it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the lockbox was all about that Al Gore so terribly explained to us. And everybody's going, lockbox, lockbox, what's a lockbox? And George W. Bush just stood there and said, it's just a matter of opinion. I think we should be able to use the Social Security Trust Fund money. But they don't raise taxes to pay for it. So in other words, if I borrow money from you, Tom, and say I need to, you know, I want to buy something, I want to buy a new guitar, but I don't have a way to pay you back, and then I go out and charge other things on my Visa, and you're the second in line, Visa says, oh, well, you got to pay your bill, but Tom's not going to get his money back. That's why Tom's note is in deficit.
So the net-net answer to this, I'm assuming, is to raise the cap.
You got to raise the cap. And then the other thing is to, since you just pointed out, which also drove me to distraction a few minutes ago, was that the Social Security Trust Fund right now has about $2.8 trillion in it.
Right.
The Republicans are trying to tell us it's insolvent when we can bail out the banks for $3.8 trillion.
Right.
When all of this comes from the general treasury, you see, they could be putting that into the Social Security Trust Fund and say, no, we got to earmark that because those are so-called IOUs, but those are actually special issue treasury bonds that they must pay with full faith and credit of the United States government. But they're saying, well, you know, we have to put it, they only have to pay them when they come due. But when these bonds become mature and they have to be sold, redeemed, to pay off the Social Security benefits, this is why they're saying that, oh, Social Security is insolvent. It means insolvent because I'd rather give the money to my friend Jamie Dimon's bank rather than put it back into the Social Security Trust Fund. That's what it really means.
Yep. You're absolutely right, Paul. You're absolutely right. And basically, the Republicans looking at Social Security are saying, hey, wait a minute. Here's a government program that is successful and has been for almost a century, number one. And number two, it's so successful, it's sitting on $2.5 trillion in surplus. Number one, we've got to destroy this. It's a successful government program. Number two, there's $2.5 trillion there. We got to figure out a way to steal that money.
Exactly.
And that's what's going on. That's the whole Pete Peterson thing. That's the whole right wing thing. That's the it's insolvent. It's going to go away. You're never going to have it. That's brainwashing the young Republicans. Paul, thank you very much. And please let us know when your speech is coming up a little closer, and we'll help promote that as well. Paul and Woodville, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place, same outrage. And don't forget, democracy requires all of us to participate. So let them know you're there. Get out there. Get active. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.